The apartment building in The Hague was still underway. My guards told me that I would be leaving for the United States. They drove me home. I had 3 hours to pack. I didn't know what to bring. The security people just said I would be going to the United States. Would it be hot or cold? My brain had simply stopped functioning. I randomly shoved every piece of clothing I owned and dozens of books into suitcases, and when I ran out of suitcases, huge plastic zip bags. The whole thing was irrational, but nobody was there to tell me so. The guards just wordlessly crammed the bags into their armored cars. I was driven to Falkenburg Air Base near The Hague, where we parked on the runway. Facing us was a military transport and surveillance aircraft, an Orion. As I walked up the jetway, I told myself like a schoolteacher, "Pay attention. This is a unique experience." I felt oddly disembodied, completely calm. All the shutters had been pulled down on the windows, and I was told not to go near them or the doors. The plane was full of soldiers in uniform. Two DKDB bodyguards were still with me. The senior guard was Pete, whom I had asked for and trusted. The pilots invited me to watch the takeoff from the cockpit. They explained their job and the technology of the airplane. I asked a few polite questions. It was very cold. They said I could lie down on one of the two flip-down beds, so high up on the wall that I couldn't roll over without my knees or shoulders hitting the ceiling. I lay there, thinking about Theo and the enormous guilt I would forever feel. We landed at the air base in Portland, Maine. Two Dutch policemen, who usually dealt with criminals in the Dutch Witness Protection Program, came to pick us up. They didn't treat me personally like a criminal. I was a member of parliament under protection, not the usual drug dealer. But they treated the situation authoritatively, as they were used to. They were the experts. They determined what I could and couldn't do. I was still frightened. They could see me looking around, startled at the slightest noise, and they tried to calm me down. First, they took me to a nondescript roadside motel, where I showered and tried to sleep while a couple of the guards took my passport and dealt with officially entering me into the country. Then we drove to Andover, Massachusetts. Again, they got rooms in the same kind of dismal motel, surrounded by highways in an industrial area with hardly any human beings. It was freezing cold. The security people had decided that I should become completely anonymous in this typically American place where no Dutch person would recognize me. We ended up staying there for weeks. All I wanted was to follow the news in Holland. I wanted to know what had happened to Theo's family, to his son, to Parliament, how the police siege in The Hague had ended. But there was no news about Holland in America, and my guards had removed the phone from my hotel room. They might not have been treating me precisely as they would a criminal, but they were at the very least treating me like a child, as if I were oblivious to the danger I faced. I argued with Coes, the man from the witness protection. I wanted to phone. I wanted to talk with my friends. But he replied that they were in charge of my safety, and this was for my own protection. Nor was I allowed to go on the internet. That, too, could be traced. I thought surely no one could trace me if I went only on news sites. But there were rules, apparently. No internet. Thankfully, my guard Pete was from the DKDB, not witness protection. He had been with the police for more than 20 years and knew the difference between what was life-threatening and what wasn't. Pete insisted that someone check out the Boston Library and see if I could log onto the internet there. He said, "We are responsible for her safety, but it's no good to anyone if she has a breakdown." While Coase went to Boston, Pete passed me his own phone and told me to be careful what I said. He walked to the other end of the room while I called Johanna, Iris, my friend Geeske. We talked guardedly about my going somewhere for a short while. They told me the news in Holland, the siege in The Hague had ended, and seven people had been arrested around the country on suspicion of links with some kind of terrorist group. When Coase got back, he reported, "It's no good. Boston is teeming with Dutch people and all kinds of Europeans. We can't rule anything out. You are not going." The next day, the guards decided to take me to a shopping mall to buy fake glasses. But Americans are so curious, they pepper you with questions, even for simple transactions in shops. The guard said, "Just tell them your name is Jill Steele and you're from South Africa." I was a black woman in a baseball cap with four big white men around her, wanting to buy clear glasses with no prescription, with a ridiculous story about South Africa. I could feel everybody in that shopping mall scrutinizing me. The next day was my 35th birthday. I had planned a party in Holland with dozens of friends. Now, just a few of my closest friends would meet without me to talk about what I should do next. Meanwhile, I had nothing to do. I had a laptop with me, but couldn't write. I had books, but I couldn't seem to take anything in. Pete could tell things were not well with me. He said once, "The way they defy in keeping you safe, we might as well lock you in a World War II bunker on the beach and pass plates of food through the door." I said that would be an improvement. I'd be on the beach in Holland and I could invite friends for tea. Pete's solution was physical exercise. Physical exhaustion was the only cure for sleeplessness, fear and worry, he said. He drove me to a huge sports center and made me work out on machines. He was right, it helped. In Holland, questions were building about my whereabouts. Since Theo's murder, I had more or less disappeared from the face of the earth. My friends were told I wanted to be alone, but they didn't buy it. They knew that at such a time, I would want to be with them, or at the very least, phone. In the absence of any information, all kinds of conspiracy theories sprouted. Some people said that I had been killed and my murder was being hushed up by the authorities. After I had been in the United States for about 10 days, the security people authorized Nelly Cruz to call me. She and Josias van Aartsen were trying to make arrangements to see me, but so far the security people were saying it was impossible. I realized that she and Josias had no idea how far away I was. Henk Kamp, the Minister of Defense, called me too. He said, "I will come and see you, and we'll go for a walk in the Zutphen Forest." I said, "Henk, don't you know that I'm nowhere near the Zutphen Forest?" It was like I was a one-woman state of emergency. Even the Minister of Defense didn't know where I was. Months later, when I saw Henk again, and everything was back to normal, I asked him how he could have been kept in ignorance of my whereabouts. He told me, "Only the Minister of Justice was supposed to know where you are. Pete Hyndonna told the rest of the cabinet, please don't ask about her location, so we didn't." Pete Hyndonna is not a bad man. He's not a strong leader, but he's a very decent person, just from some other era, and he doesn't micromanage his department. I expect Donna gave the order, keep her safe, and let his civil servants deal with it. Those men had never been confronted with this kind of situation, but their jobs were at stake. So they made me utterly, utterly safe. I'm sure they meant well. After two long and empty weeks passed, Nelly called again at the end of November. She told me I would be allowed to go back to Holland for a few days, to talk to a few people about my situation and see when I could be allowed to go back for good. I was so relieved. On November 27, after 25 days in hiding, we drove to the Portland main airport in a heavy rain. We landed at Eindhoven Air Base, and then I was driven around for what seemed like hours in a convoy. The cars all stopped on the side of a highway, and I was moved into a much smaller, nondescript car. Coase from the Witness Protection Program drove me to a house in the countryside, somewhere near Zelhelm. When it was time to meet Nelly and van Aartsen for dinner, I was driven out in the small Volkswagen. Again, we switched to a convoy of BMWs in a country clearing. It was dark. Finally, I arrived at a brick building somewhere in the middle of the woods. All the lights were out. The entryway stank of urine. One of the guards said it was the smell of the old holding cells. This was a disused police station. There was no electricity, just little plate warmer candles for lights. Blotting paper was taped over all the windows. A table was laid with a paper cloth, some sandwiches, and a couple of bottles of water and juice. We were in Holland, the 15th or 16th largest economy in the world, and I was meeting a European Union commissioner and the leader of a governing party here, skulking around in this weird Boy Scout fantasy. I am grateful that I have been protected, grateful to be alive, but there was something excessive about all this security. Nelly and Van Aerten arrived and were hustled in quickly. When I hugged Nelly, I felt like crying again. Josias looked harassed. He was in the middle of preparing for a party congress the next day, and his life had been threatened too. He was also living with bodyguards now. We sat facing each other in the room that had been prepared. Nelly raised her eyebrows and said, "Goodness." You could tell from her whole tone that she thought all this cloak and dagger stuff was perfectly ridiculous. She said, "So, it's safe here. Why couldn't we meet at my house?" After the guards closed the door, Josias asked where I had been. I told him, a motel in an industrial area in the United States, between highways, no contact with friends, talking only to bodyguards. Nelly was livid. I said, "If I must go back there for a while longer, I want at least some way of communicating, a place to get some news and email people. I need to spend more time with fellow human beings. Two men from the Justice Ministry were supposed to be meeting us after dinner. The chief of the terror fighting department and the chief of the unit of protection and security." Nelly and Josias grilled them about why I had to live this way, in such total isolation, so far away. Exactly what kind of attack did they really expect? Finally, after weeks of passive acceptance, something inside me sparked to life. I said to those men, "I will bow to your judgment about when I can come back permanently, because this is your job. But I'm not going back to that motel. In America, nobody recognizes me. I want permission to go to a university. I want to be writing, reading, doing something with myself. I can't look at that highway for longer than a few more days." Nelly swept them out with a pointed look and closed the door. She told me that my friends in Holland were agitating to find out what had happened to me. People wanted to know where I was. Newspapers were questioning the need for all the security. Part of bringing me to Holland was to quiet this sort of thing and show people that I was all right. We agreed that before I returned to America, I would meet a very good friend of mine, Herman, and also a reporter from the daily paper NRC Handelsblad. Josias suggested I also write a statement to make it clear that I was all right, which he would read to the assembled party members the next day. I spent that next day alone in the house in Zelhem, waiting for decisions to be made. Finally, I was told I would meet Nelly, have dinner with Herman, and then receive Frank Vermeulen from the NRC for an interview. They wouldn't tell me where I was going, though it was easy to recognize the Ministry of Finance when we drove in. They sat me down in a large empty office, and Nelly arrived with a bottle of champagne. We settled down to write a text for Josias to read to the assembled liberals. Then Herman came in, and I asked him to find a university in America where I could go that would be acceptable to the people at the Justice Ministry. It was so good to see them, to talk. I was overwhelmed. Two friends at once, after so long alone, felt almost too rich for me. When Nelly's champagne was finished, Herman asked for another glass. I went to the guard at the door and asked, "Could we have a bottle of wine?" He said, "But after dinner you have an interview with a reporter, you can't drink wine." Herman said, "Jesus, what is this?" He couldn't believe the way I was living and being treated. I suppose I was already used to it, but now that I was back in Holland, it was starting to seem odd, even to me. At the NRC interview, one of the civil servants in charge of my security cheered, insisted on being present to assess whether I said anything that could endanger my security. When he walked in, Frank Vermeulen raised both eyebrows at the arrangement. When the interview ended, I asked Sheard to leave and settle back just to talk to Frank as a friend. When the door closed, Frank asked, "How long is this going to go on? They can't keep you out of the country forever. It's madness. You are a member of parliament, and you've done nothing wrong. But you even have a minder listening in. It's like the old Soviet Union." I told him, "I don't understand half the stuff that happens. Sometimes it feels as if they don't trust me with my own life." The next day I was told, "You're going to a neighboring country, and then you're going to Massachusetts." The guard shift had changed. They rotated every 8 days. And I knew none of these new guards. They wouldn't tell me any more than that. We drove across the border far into Germany to a sordid, filthy hotel in a town called Meckenheim, though I didn't know that at the time. There, I decided I couldn't take it anymore. I needed to stand up for myself. I walked out, just walked out of the hotel to get coffee and some fresh air. A junior DKDB officer, Robert, was on guard in the corridor. He looked at me as if I were in the throes of acute psychosis, ran after me and asked, "What do you think you are doing?" I told him, "I'm getting coffee," and kept walking. Robert was a trained police officer, trained to guard, so he walked after me. Outside the hotel, the road was deserted. It was freezing. I saw a sign. I said, "Okay, we are in Meckenheim, and that's in Germany. We'll follow the signs to the center of town." A few feet behind me, Robert was on the phone with Henrik. He was armed, but he was very nervous. I wasn't. The air was fresh and clean, and it felt good to walk. But it was a Sunday morning, and most places in Meckenheim are closed. I caught sight of a bar, peeked through, and asked, "Coffee?" Neither I nor Robert spoke German. The barman nodded. He was Turkish. It was a Turkish coffee bar. Robert looked paralyzed with shock. I admit, I too felt a little scared. But I sat down and pretended it was the most delicious coffee I had ever tasted. Deep in my heart, I wanted to run away as quickly as I could. But I needed my dignity more. I needed to reclaim my life. So I drank that coffee very slowly and ordered another cup. As more Turkish guest workers came in, Robert moved his hand to his phone. He didn't want to have this fight on his own. But I told him, "These are innocent people. They have a business to run. They won't shoot their clients." Finally, I stood up, said, "Danke," and walked out. About 5 yards down the road, we both burst out laughing. I said, "You're relieved, aren't you?" Robert said, "Yes." And I said, "Me too." He said, "See? There can be danger everywhere." And I said, "No, they didn't do anything to us, just sold us coffee. Let's walk. We're not going to sit in that morgue of a hotel." When we got back, I was swept off to a luxurious spa for rich old people, which was not what I wanted either. I wasn't demanding luxury. I just didn't want to sleep in a room that stunk. I was returned to Massachusetts, back to the horrible motel outside Andover. I decided to send Theo's son a present for Sinterklaas, the Dutch Santa Claus who brings gifts on December 5. 2 weeks later, my package was returned unopened. Theo's son wanted nothing from me. That felt bad. I was again very low. The days crept by with no news of any transfer. My new guards didn't want me leaving the hotel, even to go to the gym. I begged constantly for the phone. Talking to friends was the only thing I could do, the only way I could stay sane. But there was a new rule. I wasn't to use the phone unless my guards were present, listening. It was like being imprisoned. I withdrew even further into myself and began spending most of the time alone in my room. Finally, the news came. I was to be transferred to San Diego. I couldn't yet make use of the university facilities. That was still waiting for clearance. But it was warm there, and Pete was back on my security detail. He drove me to the beach and had me hike through the dunes in the sharp sea air for hours. He let me use his phone, and he kept his distance so he wouldn't overhear my conversations. I began to revive and to sleep properly, purely from physical exhaustion, for the first time since Theo died. The day before Christmas, Nelly called. We agreed I would go back to Holland on January 10. When the day came, I was flown to Frankfurt, Germany, even though I wanted to be in Holland. I wanted to be home, preparing for the press conference that I was scheduled to give on January 18 in The Hague. But this wasn't allowed for some reason. We went to one German hotel, then another. Why? Nobody ever explained it. It was just security. The second hotel had a computer, an internet connection. I settled down to write the statements I would give when I returned to work. I wanted to email a draft of my ideas to my friends, but the internet connection in my room didn't work. So around midnight, I asked the guards to accompany me to reception and asked if I could email it from there. The man at the reception was Turkish. He looked at me and said, "Hey, are you by any chance that Somali woman who is a member of parliament in the Netherlands whose friend was murdered?" In the months since Theo's death, I had seen a few people recognize me from time to time. I saw surprise on their faces. But this was the first time anyone had confronted me. I said, "What?" The clerk said, "You are her." There was a letter on his body threatening her, and she disappeared. And it's you, isn't it? I made a silly laugh and said, "Oh, no, many people make that mistake, but I'm not her." This was an absolute breach of security. This clerk was completely unknown to me, and he had my room number. I asked my guards, "Are you sure it's wise to stay here?" But Case, the senior guard, said, "Tomorrow I'll call the office. All this moving around, it's not good for your rest." It could have been laughable, only my life was at stake. I went to my room and piled furniture and suitcases in front of the door and balanced the coffee machine and some cups and saucers on top, just in case I fell asleep, so I would hear if someone tried to come in. I spent the night awake, waiting for the noise and the man with the knife and the gun. Next morning, Case got the order to transfer me to a hotel in Aachen, along with a reprimand for not having moved me immediately. We were creeping closer to The Hague. I wasn't allowed to leave my hotel room now, because receptionists recognized me. I wanted to get in contact with Theo's parents before I went back to Holland, so I asked Case to arrange for me to call them. But he told me, "We've talked to their police contact person, and they don't want to have contact with you. When they're ready for contact, they'll seek it." I found out later this wasn't true. Theo's parents have been utterly warm and welcoming to me. They never told anyone such a thing. I guess someone at Justice couldn't be bothered to make the call. I asked if I could meet with my friend Paul Schaeffer, the critic, so he could help me with my text, which was too long and too emotional. I wanted to be professional and talk about my work, but I also needed to say that I was sad about Theo, that I felt guilty he had died, and I wanted to convey the message that I and Holland had to move forward, not bow to terror. I was driven into Holland on January 15. Paul and I met in a police station in Driebergen and came up with a much shorter text. I spent the night in a military helicopter base in Soesterberg. It didn't matter now. We were nearly home. Just to be back in Holland felt good. The next day was Sunday, and I was taken to Leon de Winter's house. I could barely contain my relief and happiness. Leon was there, and his wife, Jessica, and Afshin Elian, the Iranian law professor I first met at the Bali, as well as Jaffa Fink and Chris Rutherfrans from Trau. I was overcome with the need to touch, to hug them all. On Tuesday morning, I returned to Parliament. When I stepped out of the car in the cobbled courtyard, a huge bank of cameras faced me. Every time I stepped forward, they all moved back in formation. The chairman of parliament welcomed me back formally in his office, and then I went to see Josias van Aerten, who greeted me warmly. We walked into the Liberal caucus meeting, the usual meeting that happens every Tuesday morning. Almost every Liberal MP came up and kissed me. All the envy and bad feeling seemed to have melted away. The caucus meeting settled down into an interminable discussion of where committee meetings should be held, in a meeting room in Parliament or at the offices of the Liberal Party. It was as if I had never been gone. I excused myself and spent the morning working on the text of my speech in my office and making phone calls, unhampered by listening ears. At 2 p.m., I walked into the lower chamber of Parliament. It was full of reporters and MPs. All of them stood up and applauded, even the ones who had always disagreed with everything I said. The chairman made a short speech, and the Minister of Defense, Henk Kamp, came over to shake my hand and welcomed me home with real warmth in his eyes. At 4 p.m., I walked over to the news center for my press conference. It's an easy walk, but the photographers and cameramen jostled each other, filming every step I took. The room was crammed with reporters. I took a deep breath and started to read my speech. I had been gone from Parliament for 75 days, but now I was home. Epilogue. The letter of the law. It was 16 months later, Monday evening, May 1506, when Gerrit Zalm, the finance minister, came to my apartment in The Hague. With him was Willibrord van Beek, the new Liberal Party caucus leader. Both looked grim. They had a message for me. My apartment was full of people, and the only place we could talk in private was among piles of laundry drying in my spare bedroom. I asked Gerrit, "Tell me the bad news fast." Looking me straight in the eye, he told me that the integration minister Rita Verdonk was planning to nullify my Dutch citizenship. I would receive the official letter from the Ministry of Justice sometime in the next half hour. Rita had assured him that she would not make the news public until the following day, when I would announce that I was resigning from Parliament. I struggled not to show emotion, but Van Beek looked on the verge of tears as he said to me, "We won't let this happen." Gerrit said angrily that it was a farce, and I should get a good lawyer, and when they left he looked so sad that I felt compelled to comfort him. "Don't worry," I said, "everything will be fine." I kept my tears back until they had gone. 5 minutes after Gerrit left, Rita called. Our conversation was brief and cold. She told me there was nothing personal about her decision. She said she couldn't do anything about it, her hands were tied. She had been forced to determine that my Dutch citizenship was invalid. Because I had given a false name and date of birth when I applied for my nationality in 1997, citizenship had never been granted me in the first place. 10 minutes after Rita and I had said our clipped goodbyes, the doorbell rang. It was one of the security guards from the DKDB, a friendly man who usually had a loopy grin. Only now he wasn't smiling. In his hand was a white envelope printed with the logo of Justice holding her scales. "Dear Madam," the letter announced, "I hereby inform you that in my judgment you have not received Dutch citizenship due to the use of incorrect personal data during the naturalization process. The decree that naturalized you is void. You have 6 weeks to respond." I had barely finished reading the letter when the TV news opened with a report that Rita Verdonk had declared that I had never been a Dutch citizen. I was no longer Dutch. This strange turn of events had actually begun weeks before, on April 27, the last Thursday before the parliamentary spring break. My schedule had been full of appointments all week, and I was a bit frantic from it, but there was one I was looking forward to in particular. A documentary producer from a program called Zembla was coming to Parliament to talk to me about the places I had grown up in Kenya and Somalia, and to show me some raw footage he had filmed there. He set up a VCR. Once again, I saw the schools I had attended and the house in Kariokor where we first lived after Abe left us. There was my brother, Mahat, thin and nervous, wrapped in sunglasses. I was surprised that this reporter had gone to such trouble, but I was warmed by nostalgia as well as struck by the overwhelming number of Islamic headscarves now on the streets of Nairobi. When I was at Juja Road Primary School, our headmaster had refused to let my mother send us to school in headscarves. Now it seemed they were in every corridor. After he turned off the tape, the Zembla reporter peppered me with questions about my past in an unmistakably hostile tone. I was taken aback and struggled to remain courteous as he said that Mahat had told him I had never been excised. He claimed that our family was much too progressive to mutilate children's genitals. I tried to explain that Mahat was trying to save face. He didn't want to admit to an outsider that his family practiced traditions that would seem barbaric to Westerners. My brother could say what he liked, but that didn't make it true. The reporter went on, "Was it true that when I first entered Holland, I lied on my asylum application?" This was familiar ground. I had talked about it often. As soon as I entered Dutch politics, I had volunteered the fact that I had held back information on my asylum application. And subsequently, whenever I was asked about it, in private or in public, I admitted that I had lied and explained why. So once again, I told this Zembla producer that when I applied for refugee status in 1992, I did not tell the whole truth. The reporter had more questions, all with the same hostile tone, until my parliamentary assistant Iris knocked at the door. The head of the Unit for Security and Protection from the Justice Ministry had just arrived in my office, along with his deputy. I had to go. Still seething slightly from the tone of the interview, I walked in to find Arjan Jongefos from the Ministry, with an unusually compassionate look on his normally expressionless face. "Sit down," he said. "Please have a glass of water." Jongefos handed me a sheaf of legal papers. My neighbours had been suing the government to evict me from my apartment, claiming that the security around me deprived them of privacy and my presence made them unsafe. This had been going on for months, but I had never allowed myself to imagine seriously that I might lose the case. Jongefos told me the papers contained the decision of the appeals court that was considering my neighbour's case. I had just been evicted. I had 4 months to live till August 27, Jongefos kindly told me. He had gone to the trouble of working it out. I was stunned. Where could I go? To a hotel? An airbase? To some bulletproof hut in the forest? Where could I live? Where in Holland could I find a place where I would have no neighbours? The Netherlands is a small country with a lot of people. How could I function if I kept having to move from place to place? It was a blow. It may sound trivial, but when I had Jongefos's news, I felt something close to despair. Would my wandering never end? A few days later, in early May, I was scheduled to fly to the US on a long-planned trip to promote The Caged Virgin, a book of my essays. But I also intended to meet with Christopher DeMuth, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank in Washington that was interested in offering me a job. After 2.5 years as a member of parliament, I had become disenchanted and I wanted to leave Dutch politics. Months before, I had informed Gerrit Zalm that I didn't plan to run again. There were aspects of parliament I loved, like the sharpness of some debates, the matching of blade against blade. Real parliament in action can be a fine thing, but the legislative process is slow and frustrating. I didn't want to toe party lines and grow deeper in my understanding of Europe's common agricultural policy and the transportation system around Rotterdam. I didn't want to waste ridiculous amounts of energy building coalitions with people who accepted my ideas but who wouldn't vote with me because I was in the Liberal Party. The media frenzies that blew up constantly at my every comment or misstep made it difficult to function. Although the media attention did, of course, give me a platform, it also intensified the animosity that so many parliamentarians clearly felt toward me and my political initiatives. It also seemed to me that I had already achieved a big part of what I had set out to do. I had wanted Islam to be part of the political debate, and now it was. All kinds of opinion makers were now saying that it was irresponsible and indeed morally wrong to pretend that appeasing Islamic leaders would magically lead to social harmony. Dutch society was churning with discussion over how best to integrate Muslims, and Muslims in Holland also seemed largely aware now that they needed to choose between Western values and the old ways. Above all, Muslim women were now prominently on the agenda of the country. When I applied for a think tank position in the United States, I thought that perhaps it could take my ideas to a larger platform and give me more time to develop them. And now I knew that I wanted to do it sooner than expected. When the Zemblaer show aired in Holland on Thursday, May 11, under the title The Holy Ayan, I was still in the United States, but a Dutch journalist living in New York arranged for me to view it in a studio. The tone was unpleasant, and it was certainly intended as a character assassination. But friends of mine who phoned me didn't seem to think it was in any way seriously damaging. The reporter had apparently tracked down Osman Musa, who was still living in Canada, and he had claimed that I had married him willingly. But as someone said to me, who would admit to marrying a girl who didn't want to be married to him? It seemed pretty clear that the reporter had gone to Kenya and Somalia to try to dig up dirt about me. If this was all he could come up with, I thought then I was doing fine. But then the drum rolls began. As the minister in charge of immigration affairs, Rita Verdonk, had in the past ordered that a number of asylum seekers be deported from Holland because they had lied on their residency applications. The day after the Holy Ayan show aired, Rita faced taunts that she ought now to deport Ayan Hirsi Ali just as she would any other lying immigrant. Rita was my friend. Known to others as Iron Rita, she was found to be rigid, and they constantly taunted her about her former job as a prison warden. I, however, had always found her to be warm, even motherly. Although we frequently disagreed about policy, she was often my ally in our party and in parliament. We exchanged ideas, and she used bits and pieces of my proposals. I also intervened with her frequently on behalf of asylum seekers she was planning to have deported. Rita was one of the people who had comforted me after Theo's death. In a caucus where I had few friends, she had gone to a lot of trouble on my behalf. And Rita knew very well that I had lied on my asylum application. Even if she hadn't read my interviews on the subject, and why should she have? We had spoken of it several times, most recently just a few weeks before, after she had decided to deport an 18-year-old girl from Kosovo, Taida Passage, although she was due to take her final high school exams. I had phoned Rita from Leon de Winter's house, where I was having dinner, and pleaded with her to reconsider the girl's case, but Rita was adamant. "She lied," Rita told me then. "My hands are tied." "But Rita, I lied too," I said. Leon heard me. Rita's words, "If I had been the minister when you applied for asylum, then I would have deported you as well." On Friday, the day after the broadcast of the documentary, Rita publicly announced that I had nothing to fear from her. But Rita was running hard to be elected leader of the Liberal Party. The vote was scheduled for May 30. She could not afford to look weak. "Rules are rules," was her mantra, and she was adamant that she could not make any exceptions. And so on Saturday morning, the day after calls began demanding that she examine my status as a lying asylum seeker, Rita let it be known that she was investigating my immigration file. I suddenly felt like that foolish, trusting nomad from the tales grandma used to tell me as a child. By Sunday, I had heard rumors that Rita was planning to retract my citizenship. So had everyone in the country. It was in the newspapers. My passport could be taken away. If I was no longer Dutch, I couldn't vote. It went without saying that I was no longer a member of parliament. Would I even be allowed to remain in the country? Without a passport, would I be able to travel? If I were no longer in parliament, would I have bodyguards? I was incredulous. Even when Khalid Salam walked into my apartment that Monday night and told me it was really happening, and I received the letter from the ministry, even then the whole thing still seemed completely unreal. When I woke up on Tuesday morning, my voicemail was overflowing with calls. Hundreds of emails jammed my inbox. Due to hold a press conference that afternoon, I settled in to think about what I was going to say. The manuscript pages of my memoir were scattered across my printer. "I am Ayan, the daughter of Hirsi, the son of Magan," I read. How could this be happening when I had so repeatedly told the truth about my real past? Yes, I should have told the whole truth in 1992 when I arrived in Holland, even though I was frightened of being sent home. In time, as I learned not to be afraid, I learned that it was wrong not to tell the truth. Now, having been truthful, I had no idea what my citizenship was, or even if I could remain in Holland. The only thing that was clear to me was that I should resign from Parliament earlier than I had planned. That afternoon, I walked into the news centre beside Parliament and faced the cameras again. I announced that I was leaving politics and that I would be leaving Holland. I thanked various people for their support and tried to sum up what I thought I had achieved. My hands were shaking and my throat was dry. A few hours later, Christopher DeMuth called from the American Enterprise Institute and confirmed that I would have a job there in September. My press conference that Tuesday was at 2 p.m. By 4:45, Rita Verdonk was in Parliament answering questions from my angry colleagues. For over 3 years, I had worked with these men and women, eaten with them, socialized, made alliances, traded votes. Now, after an internal inquiry that had lasted just 4 days, I was no longer a Dutch citizen, and as a result, I had been stripped of my position beside them. Most members of parliament were outraged, and they made no secret of it. At around 11 that night, under heavy questioning in parliament, Rita stumbled. She said I had never been Dutch. Then she claimed that I was now Dutch for a 6-week waiting period, even though I had never been Dutch in the first place. She claimed to have no idea that I had lied on my asylum application. She said she had never heard of me using another name, despite the fact that there were dozens of examples where I had. Whether it was in the press, in earlier publications, or even in simple everyday parts of my life, such as my email address in Parliament, which was magan@tweedekamer.nl, the Dutch equivalent of aparlement.netherlands, I had made no secret that in my youth my family name was Hirsi Magan. Rita's support in the lower chamber of Parliament began falling away. The calculus of self-interest that hums just beneath the surface of politics was in action now, and this was no longer about me. Rita Verdonk would have been a strong leader of the VVD, and so the VVD's opponents wanted her destroyed. Within our own Liberal Party too, there were people who were prepared, even delighted, to sacrifice her, whether on this pretext or some other. By this time, millions of Dutch people were tuned in to the parliamentary debate on live TV. They watched as Rita was slowly torn to pieces in the arena. Leaders of the governing coalition began edging away from her on the podium. 2 motions instructing her to review my case were tabled. Sometime around 2:30 in the morning, the chairman of the parliament apparently passed her a note warning her that she must accept the next motion or she would be forced to step down from government. Abruptly, at around 3 in the morning, she agreed to reopen my case and review my naturalization. I would receive a decision within 6 weeks. From this point on, the whole situation became a farce. I found a lawyer who told me that because I used the name Ali, which was the birth name of my grandfather known as Magan, I hadn't, in fact, fraudulently filled in any forms. She also filed a document analyzing Somali law, which showed that I had a right to use any name in the long list of my male ancestors as my family name. I hadn't known that. Because I was unable to procure birth certificates for my grandfather, father, and mother as requested, I obtained a statement from my brother confirming that my grandfather, Magan, was named Ali at his birth. Then I settled back to wait. As the weeks passed, I heard the rumors like everyone else. Jan-Peter Balkenende, the Prime Minister, wanted Rita to retract her decision and reinstate me as an honorable Dutch citizen. But Rita didn't want to lose face. Finally, just 2 days before Parliament was due to break up for the summer, Balkenende scheduled a meeting with her late on Monday night, June 26, and insisted that she inform Parliament that she was retracting her decision, making me Dutch again. When I heard about this meeting, just before it happened, I was in Washington, in the office of the lawyer who was helping me with my U.S. immigration. My phone rang at about 3 p.m. It was my Dutch lawyer telling me that I must urgently fax a declaration stating that I would henceforth always use Ali as my name and not another name like Magan. Once I did that, everything would be fine with my Dutch citizenship. I had to find a FedEx office in downtown Washington to send it immediately. It was too urgent to wait. A few hours later, a real estate broker was showing me around an apartment for rent in Washington when the phone rang again. There was another declaration that I must sign before everything could be resolved. I should state that I was to blame for the entire business because I had told reporters that I had lied when I called myself Ali, when in actual fact I hadn't lied. I was legally permitted to use the name. I wanted to get the whole thing behind me. I no longer had a home in Holland. Without Dutch citizenship, I would be stalled in my application for a U.S. visa. Not to sign this statement could lead to years of insecurity and legal battles. My lawyers, who were in constant contact with The Hague, told me that I was not allowed to change a word in the statement. I had to take it or leave it. I did, however, manage to get one change put through. I took out, "I am sorry," and replaced it with, "I regret." Apparently, Prime Minister Balkenende made Rita promise in return never again to say rules are rules. The next day, Tuesday, I was at the office of the American Enterprise Institute when Dutch reporters began arriving with camera equipment. I hadn't received any notification yet, but they had heard that Rita had agreed to reinstate my Dutch citizenship. I simply said how glad I was. That was it. I just wanted the matter closed. But the reporters told me a debate had already been scheduled in Parliament for Wednesday evening, just before Parliament broke for the summer. People in The Hague were saying that I had been blackmailed into writing the letter accepting blame and that it was shameful behavior by Rita Verdonk. There was no blackmail, and I told the reporters so. There was only the pressure of time. I wanted the whole thing finished so I could put it behind me. When the debate in Parliament opened at 8 p.m. on Wednesday night, June 28, Rita Verdonk and Prime Minister Balkenende came under attack almost immediately. Rita had notified Balkenende by voicemail of her original decision to take away my naturalization and then never got back to him before it was announced. What kind of leadership was that? It was also obvious that many members of Parliament felt that the government was insulting their intelligence by claiming that the whole thing was essentially my fault. In the early hours of the morning, Balkenende was asked in Parliament if I had been obligated to put my signature to a document taking blame for the whole affair, whether that had been a precondition for me to get back my citizenship. He said yes, it was a precondition. Rita had insisted that I should sign the statement or there was no deal. The floor of Parliament erupted in a frenzy as members rushed for the microphone. At 4:30 a.m., the Green Party called for a motion of no confidence in Rita Verdonk. Many people across the country were still up and watching on TV. When the votes were counted, 66 members supported it and 79 were against, which meant that D66, a small party that was one of the three partners in the governing coalition, had voted no confidence in the government's minister. Either Rita would have to resign, or there was no longer a coalition and the government would collapse. It was now June 29, the last day of the parliamentary term. At 9 a.m, there was an emergency meeting of the cabinet. The Prime Minister emerged after lunch and told the press that Rita would stay on as minister. It was up to D66 to decide what to do about it. Their six members quit the coalition that evening. Balkan Ender's government had fallen. New elections would have to be called in the fall. As the drama unfolded, I was kept abreast of it by text message. Friends of mine on the parliamentary staff, as well as my former colleagues, sent me hundreds of them. When the government collapsed, I received more than 50 messages, almost simultaneously. By that point, I was in Aspen, Colorado, where I had been invited to attend a conference at the Aspen Institute with a constellation of American politicians and heads of corporations. I was taken aback by how many people kept coming up to me to tell me how angry they were with the Dutch government. I found myself constantly explaining that Holland wasn't a xenophobic country and had not suddenly kicked me out. I tried to tell people that I very much regretted the collapse of Balkan Ender's cabinet, because a government should not fall apart over such a minor issue. It leads to voter cynicism. People elect their leaders to make tough, big decisions, and this was a very small one. Above all, I told these people that Holland is a peaceful country, open and tolerant and free. It was in Holland that I became a free individual, and I am Dutch, completely Dutch again, and very glad to be. Whatever your feelings on the subject, the United States is the leader of the free world. By taking my ideas to the US, I don't feel in any way that I am selling out. At the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, I will have more time to think than when I was a member of parliament in The Hague, trying to wheel and deal programs in the legislative process. At the risk of repeating myself, I'm not leaving Holland because of the issue of my Dutch citizenship. It's an entirely personal decision made long before the citizenship saga came about. Years ago, fresh out of Leiden, I thought that politics was a truly noble pursuit and that the institutions of democracy were humanity's means to better the world. I still think that's true. But I have learned that like every other kind of human pursuit, politics can be an ugly game, clan against clan, party against party, candidate against candidate, with governments falling over trivial issues. Watching power will, I hope, be more agreeable than practicing it. The freedom of expression that I found in Holland, the freedom to think, is unknown where I come from. It's a right and practice that I always dreamed of having as I was growing up. Whatever its flaws, no nation understands the principle of free expression better than the Dutch. It runs so deep in Dutch culture that Holland has chosen to protect me against death threats, even though members of the government constantly tell me how much they disagree with my ideas. I must say how grateful I am. I am lucky and privileged to be Dutch. Mohamed Bouyeri, Theo's murderer, and others like him don't realize how deeply people in the West are committed to the idea of an open society. Even though the open society is vulnerable, it's also stubborn. It's the place I ran to for safety and freedom. I would like to keep it that way, safe and free. People are always asking me what it is like to live with death threats. It's like being diagnosed with a chronic disease. It may flare up and kill you, but it may not. It could happen in a week, or not for decades. The people who ask me this usually have grown up in rich countries, Western Europe and America after the Second World War. They take life for granted. Where I grew up, death is a constant visitor. A virus, bacteria, a parasite. Drought and famine. Soldiers and torturers could bring it to anyone, anytime. Death comes riding on raindrops that turned to floods. It catches the imagination of men in positions of authority who order their subordinates to hunt, torture and kill people they imagine to be enemies. Death lures many others to take their own lives in order to escape a dismal reality. For many women, because of the perception of lost honor, death comes at the hands of a father, brother, or husband. Death comes to young women giving birth to new life, leaving the newborn orphaned in the hands of strangers. For those who live in anarchy and civil war, as in the country of my birth, Somalia, death is everywhere. When I was born, my mother initially thought death had taken me away, but it didn't. When I got malaria and pneumonia, I recovered. When my genitals were cut, the wound healed. When a bandit held a knife to my throat, he decided not to slit it. When my Quran teacher fractured my skull, the doctor who treated me kept death at bay. Even with bodyguards and death threats, I feel privileged to be alive and free. When I took the train to Amsterdam 13 years ago, I took a chance at life in freedom, a life in which I would be free from bondage to someone I had not chosen, and in which my mind too could be free. I first encountered the full strength of Islam as a young child in Saudi Arabia. It was very different from the diluted religion of my grandmother, which was mixed with magical practices and pre-Islamic beliefs. Saudi Arabia is the source of Islam and its quintessence. It's the place where the Muslim religion is practiced in its purest form, and it's the origin of much of the fundamentalist vision that has in my lifetime spread far beyond its borders. In Saudi Arabia, every breath, every step we took was infused with concepts of purity or sinning and with fear. Wishful thinking about the peaceful tolerance of Islam cannot interpret away this reality. Hands are still cut off, women still stoned and enslaved, just as the Prophet Muhammad decided centuries ago. The kind of thinking I saw in Saudi Arabia and among the Muslim Brotherhood in Kenya and Somalia is incompatible with human rights and liberal values. It preserves a feudal mindset based on tribal concepts of honor and shame. It rests on self-deception, hypocrisy, and double standards. It relies on the technological advances of the West while pretending to ignore their origin in Western thinking. This mindset makes the transition to modernity very painful for all who practice Islam. It's always difficult to make the transition to a modern world. It was difficult for my grandmother and for all my relatives from the Mi'i. It was difficult for me too. I moved from the world of faith to the world of reason, from the world of excision and forced marriage to the world of sexual emancipation. Having made that journey, I know that one of those worlds is simply better than the other, not because of its flashy gadgets, but fundamentally because of its values. The message of this book, if it must have a message, is that we in the West would be wrong to prolong the pain of that transition unnecessarily by elevating cultures full of bigotry and hatred toward women to the stature of respectable alternative ways of life. People accuse me of having interiorized the feeling of racial inferiority, so that I attack my own culture out of self-hatred because I want to be white. This is a tiresome argument. Tell me, is freedom then only for white people? Is it self-love to adhere to my ancestors' traditions and mutilate my daughters? To agree to be humiliated and powerless? To watch passively as my countrymen abuse women and slaughter each other in pointless disputes? When I came to a new culture where I saw for the first time that human relations could be different, would it have been self-love to see that as a foreign cult which Muslims are forbidden to practice? Life is better in Europe than it is in the Muslim world because human relations are better. And one reason human relations are better is that in the West, life on earth is valued in the here and now, and individuals enjoy rights and freedoms that are recognized and protected by the state. To accept subordination and abuse because Allah willed it, that, for me, would be self-hatred. The decision to write this book didn't come to me easily. Why would I expose such private memories to the world? I don't want my arguments to be considered sacrosanct because I have had horrible experiences. I haven't. In reality, my life has been marked by enormous good fortune. How many girls born in Digfer Hospital in Mogadishu in November 1969 are even alive today? And how many have a real voice? I also don't want my reasoning to be dismissed as the bizarre ranting of someone who has been somehow damaged by her experiences and who is lashing out. People often imply that I am angry because I was excised or because my father married me off. They never fail to add that such things are rare in the modern Muslim world. The fact is that hundreds of millions of women around the world live in forced marriages and 6,000 small girls are excised every day. My excision in no way damaged my mental capacities, and I would like to be judged on the validity of my arguments, not as a victim. My central motivating concern is that women in Islam are oppressed. That oppression of women causes Muslim women and Muslim men too to lag behind the West. It creates a culture that generates more backwardness with every generation. It would be better for everyone, for Muslims above all, if this situation could change. When people say that the values of Islam are compassion, tolerance, and freedom, I look at reality, at real cultures and governments, and I see that it simply isn't so. People in the West swallow this sort of thing because they've learned not to examine the religions or cultures of minorities too critically, for fear of being called racist. It fascinates them that I'm not afraid to do so. In March 2005, Time magazine informed me that I would be named one of its 100 most influential people in the world today. I went straight out to buy a copy of the magazine, of course, but I was weeks early. That issue wouldn't come out until mid-April. So the magazine I bought wasn't about me, it was about poverty in Africa. The woman on the cover was young and thin with three small children. She was wrapped in the same kind of cloth my grandmother used to wear, and the look in her eyes was hopeless. It threw me back to Somalia, to Kenya, to poverty and disease and fear. I thought about the woman in that photograph and about the millions of women who must live as she does. Time had just named me to their category, leaders and revolutionaries. What do you do with a responsibility like that? Perhaps I could start by telling people that values matter. The values of my parents' world generate and preserve poverty and tyranny, for example, in their oppression of women. A clear look at this would be tremendously beneficial. In simple terms, for those of us who were brought up with Islam, if we face up to the terrible reality we are in, we can change our destiny. Why am I not in Kenya squatting at a charcoal brazier making angelos? Why have I been instead a representative in the Dutch parliament making law? I have been lucky, and not many women are lucky in the places I come from. In some sense, I owe them something. Like the Gala woman I once translated for in Sghalkar, I need to seek out the other women held captive in the compound of irrationality and superstition, and persuade them to take their lives into their own hands. Sister Aziza used to warn us of the decadence of the West, the corrupt, licentious, perverted, idolatrous, money-grabbing, soulless countries of Europe. But to me, there is far worse moral corruption in Islamic countries. In those societies, cruelty is implacable and inequality is the law of the land. Dissidents are tortured. Women are policed both by the state and by their families, to whom the state gives the power to rule their lives. In the past 50 years, the Muslim world has been catapulted into modernity. From my grandmother to me is a journey of just two generations, but the reality of that voyage is millennial. Even today, you can take a truck across the border into Somalia and find you have gone back thousands of years in time. People adapt. People who never sat on chairs before can learn to drive cars and operate complex machinery. They master these skills very quickly. Similarly, Muslims don't have to take 600 years to go through a reformation in the way they think about equality and individual rights. When I approached Theo to help him make submission, I had three messages to get across. First, men and even women may look up and speak to Allah. it's possible for believers to have a dialogue with God and look closely at Him. Second, the rigid interpretation of the Quran in Islam today causes intolerable misery for women. Through globalization, more and more people who hold these ideas have traveled to Europe with the women they own and brutalize, and it's no longer possible for Europeans and other Westerners to pretend that severe violations of human rights occur only far away. The third message is the film's final phrase, "I may no longer submit." It's possible to free oneself, to adapt one's faith, to examine it critically, and to think about the degree to which that faith is itself at the root of oppression. I am told that Submission is too aggressive a film. Its criticism of Islam is apparently too painful for Muslims to bear. Tell me, how much more painful is it to be these women trapped in that cage?
The End. You've been listening to Infidel by Ayan Hirsi Ali, narrated by the author and directed by Natanya Johnson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.